everyone. Welcome to the Passions of Real Life Legends, sponsored by Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise magazine. My name is Janet Atwood, and I'm the author of The Passion Test. And for those of you who are just now joining us for the first time, the Passions of Real Life Legends series is an opportunity for you to learn what you need to do to discover your passions and live your personal destiny by hearing from people who have been incredibly successful at doing that in their own lives. The recording and the transcript of today's interview and all of our interviews are made available exclusively to the members of our Real Life Legends Club. So since you are on this call, I know that discovering and living your passions is important to you. And that's why we're offering a free month of Real Life Legends Club membership to anyone who purchases a copy of the Passion Test Assessment. You can identify your top five passions, read the Passion Test ebook, plus get the recordings and transcripts of this call and our call on March 22nd, not to mention all the other amazing calls in the archives with people like Dr. John Gray, Neil Donald Walsh, Rabbi Yehuda Berg, and others. And to get more details about how you can get the recording and transcript of this call, write down this website address, www.healthywealthy, the letter N as in Nancy, wise.com/P as in Paul, T as in Tom, A as in Apple, .html. Again, that's www.healthywealthy, the letter N as in Nancy, wise.com/PTA.html. Those of you who are listening to this call on the webcast can just click on the picture at the top of your Real Player window to learn about club membership. Tonight, I'm honored to have my dear friend and colleague Jack Canfield as our co-host. As many of you know, Jack Canfield is co-creator of the phenomenally successful Chicken Soup for the Soul series, and he's just released his new book. It's called The Success Principles, How to Get from Where You Are to Where You Want to Be. And I encourage all of you to go to jackcanfield.com to check out this great book. Jack, welcome. It's such a pleasure to have you with us tonight, and I'll turn it over to you now. Are you there?
Yes, I am. It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you very much. I love you guys. I really appreciate what you're all trying to accomplish in the world. I know you're doing passionate work.
Thank you.
Anyway, I'm thrilled this evening to introduce to all of you on this call tonight's guest, who is one of the great thinkers and influencers of our time. In 1996, Dr. Stephen R. Covey was recognized as one of Time Magazine's 25 most influential Americans and one of Sales and Marketing Management's top 25 power brokers. He's the author of The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, which has sold over 15 million copies in 38 countries. In 2002, Forbes magazine named this book one of the top 10 most influential management books ever. Dr. Covey's latest book, The 8th Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness, is required reading for all of you listeners. This book defines what is required to live a life of greatness aligned with your own personal destiny. After tonight's call, we want everyone on this call to get a copy of this book. And you can do that by going to www.healthywealthyandwise, that's healthy, wealthy, the letter N is in Nancy, wise.com/covey.htm. And I'll recommend that again at the end of the call. So if you don't have a pencil, get one and we'll write it down then. Well, Stephen, it's a great pleasure and honor to have you with us this evening. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Jack. I'm really excited by it.
Well, it's my pleasure. I first met you in Cincinnati, Ohio at the Self-Esteem Conference there.
And I think we also met at a booksellers conference once.
Yes, we did that as well, several times. And we've been following and supporting each other's work for years, which I'm very grateful for. Anyway, today we're going to be talking about your new book. And in your new book, you refer to passion as one of the four intelligences of the 8th habit. Will you please explain what these intelligences are and what their significance is for our listeners?
Okay. Well, most people think that intelligence basically is IQ, and in other words, of the mind. But research has demonstrated for many, many years that there are other forms of intelligence. For instance, the body itself, 70 trillion cells, right now is digesting people's food, fighting disease, and doing all kinds of other things, and we're not even consciously thinking about it. Even doctors know that they don't heal. It's the body that heals. The doctors will facilitate or try to remove obstacles, but basically, the healing process is done by the body, the intelligence inside the body. It is an absolutely brilliant machine. We all know about IQ, which stands for the mind, where it deals with the power to analyze, to reason, to use logic, to use creativity, and so forth. EQ, before 1980, was called brain dominance theory. So that the left side was more the IQ side, the rational, logical mind, and the right side was more what is called today emotional intelligence, dealing with intuition, creativity, sensing, holistic thinking. It is not time-bound. It doesn't think linearly. It just is a whole different world of thinking. And now, since the research of the last 25 years has gone on, there's extensive data to show that EQ, which deals with emotional intelligence, deals with self-awareness, with empathy, with social skills, and so forth, is much more important than IQ. And then the final one is SQ, which stands for spiritual intelligence. This used to be kind of fringy, but no longer. I just finished reading my sixth book on spiritual intelligence, and it has become mainstream. There's tremendous empirical data to show that inside of us is a deep need for meaning, for a sense of adding value, for a sense of our life mattering, that it really is significant. And also, there's a need for integrity, for living by our conscience and by principles, by those universal principles and values that belong to every religion and every major culture and every philosophy and psychology that is endured. So those four intelligences, PQ for the body, EQ for the heart, SQ for the spirit, and IQ for the mind. When they join together, there's a synergy that results. And in that synergy, where the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, is really the highest form of passion and intelligence and enthusiasm. In fact, enthusiasm basically comes from the Greek root in theo, in, God in you. And so there's four these intelligences that overlap.
Now, in your own life, how have these intelligences been expressed? How you know, personalize it a little bit for us. How's that been part of your journey, and how does it interact?
Well,
and so forth?
It's interesting because I was basically kind of raised to go into a family business. And I don't know if people who are listening now have been to Salt Lake and have seen the hotel called Little America. But that was the business, and there were several of those, including motels, real estate, and gas and oil, and so forth. It was a very growing, profitable business. And I went to the Harvard Business School and kind of was the heir apparent to go into that business. And I even remember growing up having heard my father talk about teachers in kind of a way that is a little denigrating. For instance, he would say, if you can do it, you do it. If you can't do it, you teach. So I had finished my Harvard Business School training, and I was invited to train leaders, and I didn't see myself in this field at all. I didn't even, that wasn't even on the radar screen, but the person affirmed me so powerfully and so clearly that I decided, well, I'll try it. And the moment I tried it, I could feel this innate kind of intuitive sense of this is my voice, this is my calling, this is what I am supposed to do. And so it literally shifted my whole life away from that business that I was going to go into training leaders. And so that's what I have done for the last 30 years. And I remember even saying to my father that I really wanted to be a teacher. And he was very supportive and affirming. And even later told me that he didn't find his voice in business. He found it in his basement working on the development of visitor centers that would integrate architecture, history, philosophy, psychology, anthropology, a multidisciplinary approach to kind of explain life in a larger context. And that's really where his voice was. And it wasn't until he died that many of his friends even knew that. But that's where his passion was. And that's what he was excited about. So this has been a very interesting life kind of journey for me to really find my own passion in the teaching and the training of leaders.
So since this series is about passion, speak a little more deeply about the role of passion and how it's played out in your life, and why is it so important for someone to know what they're passionate about?
Well, I think that I think it was Emerson who said, nothing great was ever accomplished without enthusiasm, which is perhaps another word for passion. And I feel that when you, for instance, if I'm preparing like I am right now, tomorrow I'm going to be training a group of leaders for a very large international organization, 10 billion cells, and I've been preparing and studying their materials and studying their problems and their challenges, and the more I study it, the more I have conviction about what I'm going to teach them. So when I combine together my convictions with their need, and also by empathizing with their people, particularly their top people. I've just been visiting with the CEO and the COO and the human resource people. And then if I will also talk to people who are in the audience, I find that I totally lose all fear at all, because I get so deeply passionate about my convictions in meeting their needs that I have no fear at all. I only have an interest in helping them and in serving those needs. So it's not something that is artificial or forced. It's kind of just like a well of water that just springs up inside you after you prime the pump a little. And then it just flows. And it's almost hard to turn off. I feel so genuinely excited about what I'm going to do.
Sounds like it flows out, too, of the relationship that develops between who, what you are, and who and what they need to do, and then it comes out of that relationship. Is that true, too?
Absolutely, because I've come to learn that culture, which has to do with the quality of relationships and the norms and mores that govern people and organizations, I've come to learn that once you come to understand culture through real deep study and analysis, you start to discover that everything depends upon the quality of relationships. If they're really synergistic relationships, or if they're adversarial relationships, or if they're what I call transactional relationships, that means where you go in and buy gas and give money and you get gas, that's a transaction. Or a transformational leadership where you actually interact with another person in such a genuine way and coming to understand their needs. And your own mind has been influenced powerfully. So you're not just doing your stick on them. You literally are influenced them by them, almost like a physician would be when they come to a good diagnosis of a disease. Then you'll find that there's a natural fire and enthusiasm to meet that need. And it just comes naturally. It's not forced. It's not psyched up. It's kind of just an intuitive inward welling or a swelling inside you that we could call passion or enthusiasm or excitement. And then when you start to interact with them, and as the interaction takes place, you begin to learn more, and then they learn more, and then you overlap your vulnerable part with their vulnerable part, something magic happens. And there's a passion and enthusiasm that happens in the relationship itself. And you would never badmouth that person because it would be so, behind their back, which is a very common thing in life where you have transactions. But where you really have had a transformation through the building of trusted relationships, there is no way you would badmouth a person. You would instead be true to them behind their back. And when that happens, you've got mores and norms in the culture that transcend rules and laws, and you don't need them. Instead, you can begin to lead and manage through purpose and principles, and then you empower people and unleash their talent. Then they find their voice and their passion, and they get excited. And that's what happens inside these cultures and inside these organizations. And, for instance, the organization I'm working with tomorrow, they're trying to put together one big team so that this natural passion emerges. Well, they don't have the skill set of how to produce synergy, and that's why I'm going to focus on that.
Cool.
But they do know a little about the idea behind it. But I'll tell you, when it happens, there will be a natural fire and enthusiasm, a passion that will take place inside that culture.
That's great. Now, you said in your book that I'm going to quote you here, the call and need of a new era is for greatness. It is for fulfillment, passionate execution, and significant contribution. What is unique about this time, what you call a new era? Why does this time specifically require greatness from each of us, and what do you mean by that?
Well, when I finished the Seven Habits book in 1989, that was the year that the Berlin Wall came down, and that was generally considered the ending of the industrial age and the beginning of the information knowledge worker age. And in the last 15 years, the value added to goods and services throughout the country has about 70 to 80% has come from knowledge work. Before that, it was like 20 to 30% came from knowledge work, and the rest came from material and manual work. So there's been a profound shift toward the knowledge worker. But the industrial age model is one that suppresses passion. It suppresses empowerment. It straitjackets the unleashing of people's talents, because even the accounting system calls people an expense. I mean, duh. The greatest asset we have that leverages every other asset are people. But they're called an expense, and the psychology of being called an expense leads to the psychology of external motivation. To try to get people passionate through external psych-up or through carrot and sticking, the great jackass theory of human motivation. And then they do performance appraisal through what I call the sandwich technique, you know, the top part of the sandwich, you say a few nice words, then you slip in the knife, areas for improvement, to try to talk about what they can do and to develop their passion and enthusiasm, and then a few nice words at the end to send them on their way. It's just all obsoleting structure, systems, and practices of the industrial age. We are in a new knowledge economy. This is the day to unleash people's talents and capacities. But that kind of empowerment is a fruit of high trust cultures, of people being on the same page about what is truly important, of aligned structures and systems which reinforce those criteria. Then you have the basis for empowerment. And when you get empowerment, that's where you get passion. Because people have found their voice, and their weakness is made irrelevant through the voices of other people. So that you have a complementary team. This does not happen with immature people or insecure people who are threatened by the successes of others and who value independence more than they value interdependence and synergy. But it will happen, and the new knowledge economy will demand that it happens. That, and you study the great organizations. Look how Toyota is eating Detroit's lunch. Have you studied the kind of synergy that has happened with their suppliers and with their people? I mean, anyone with much knowledge, not only about the industry where they're economically literate, but also about their own organization, that they could even, any person can stop that line. They are so empowered and so strengthened, and they do the same thing with their suppliers. They involve their suppliers and treat them as they do their customers, instead of someone to go into transactional win-lose negotiation with. Same thing with many of the other ones, like United Technologies and Dell and Southwest Airlines. I mean, they just are at the cutting edge of this new knowledge economy, and that is drawing upon the passion and talent of people. They're helping them find their voices. That's the eighth habit. Find your voice and inspire others to find theirs. In other words, find your talent and passion that meets a need as driven by conscience. And then, once you've done that, and as you're doing it, help other people find theirs.
So, I'm sure most of the people listening here have had either themselves or a friend or somebody who's had the experience that when they were finding their voice or expressing their voice and, you know, working with the expression of their own individual uniqueness, their own core genius, if we will, unique abilities and so forth, that often they felt like they were in competition with the needs of the organization, that somehow they didn't blend. How do you get this unique individual unfoldment that often feels in conflict with the needs of these large corporations to move? How does that interrelate? How does that interact?
That's a great question, because most people take an outside-in approach to that question. That is, they want their boss to change, or they want the structures and systems to change to make it more conducive for them to find their voice and unleash their talent and passion. But the key is inside out. You don't build your security on the external world and external conditions and your boss's opinion of you and whether or not you're being encouraged or supported. Otherwise, you get into victimism. And when you get into victimism, you give your future away. You lose your passion. You lose your enthusiasm. You literally are letting yesterday hold tomorrow hostage. And that is a very common thing with most people. It really is, Jack. It's not until a person accepts responsibility, which I call habit one, they take responsibility and take initiative. Okay, so let's say that they have a bad boss, and let's say that they have bad systems and structures. The thing they do have is a competitive environment. And if they, in their own small circle of influence, can use their passion and their talent to exercise some freedom, some creativity in that small circle of influence successfully, little by little, in most cases, the pragmatic truths will convert the cynics. In a few cases, they may decide to go elsewhere. Or they may decide to seek a different position in the same organization. People can be very creative and very imaginative about how they do this. But I'll tell you, people that are full of initiative and who don't get into the blaming and victimism mentality, they'll find their voice. They truly will. And they will find an opportunity to have that voice meet a relevant human need. People who say they can't are into victimism.
So So basically what I hear you saying is if you let your unique ability out, your creative, your passion, then you're going to start producing better results, and those results are going to be what impresses people to say, wait a second, maybe we need to pay attention here. What this person or this group is doing is working, so let's give them more freedom, or even let's learn from them.
Exactly. In fact, here's an actual experience I had. I was training insurance general agents one time, and they were all complaining about the terrible training programs of the company. And I said, well, why don't you change them? And they said, well, what do you mean? Well, you're not happy with these training programs. You feel that they're just a big laser beam show and there's no sharing the best practices. Why don't you change it? Well, that's not our role. I said, look, you've argued for your weakness. Now it's yours. You're not a victim. You're the top general agents in the country, in the company. You could make any presentation you wanted to the top decision makers. And if you make that presentation wisely, in other words, make their point for them better than they can or as good as they can, first, before you make your point, you'll become a change agent. And so they literally had three of them go to Hartford, Connecticut, where the headquarters was of this large insurance company, went in to see the top people, including the CEO and the HR person in charge of training, and they sat down with them and basically said, let us share our understanding of what your training program is about and why we have it this way. And let us share also our understanding of the budget that's been put into this, the culture that has surrounded it, the present skill set that enables it to work. They shared it so deeply and so thoroughly that the top people basically said, you understand. What do you recommend? So they recommended a completely different training program, one that involved a great deal of sharing best practices and having accountability and getting support systems going, things that we know work. And they suggested they do it on a pilot basis. But the top executives were so fired up by it, they adopted it at once for the entire company. I met with this group every quarter. So the next time I met with them, and they'd had this magnificent success to the surprise and shock of almost everyone, I said, okay, guys, what stupid thing do you want to take on next? I mean, they were so full of enthusiasm and passion about what they'd accomplished for an entire company. So people have to think outside their job and inside their circle of influence and just figure out ways that they can make contributions. Now, making a recommendation is about what I call the third level of initiative. There are other levels of initiative to be taken. The key point, though, are not the seven levels of initiative. The key point is that you get out of victimism and you start tapping into your own sense of what is right and let that feed your enthusiasm and your passion.
Now, that story is a great model for our listeners to realize how they can do that, too. Now, a lot of people, if you ask them what their passion is or what their voice is or, you know, who they really are at the deepest level, they often say, I don't know. We see a lot of people have been beaten down by the educational systems and by fear-based parenting and fear-based management. How do you advise people to go about discovering their own voice if they're not clear what it is?
I would say start cultivating the four intelligences. Realize that you have the power of choice, that you're not a victim of your culture. You're not a victim of your upbringing. Those things have influenced you, but they have not determined you. So start getting in shape physically. Start paying a price in your study and education of your mind. Start learning to listen to other people. Most people have never been trained how to listen. I can ask any group anywhere, and you'll find that no more than about 1 or 2% of the people in an entire group have had more than 2 weeks of formal training in how to listen. It's amazing. And yet they've had years and years of training in how to read, write, and speak. but not to listen. They think they listen, but all they're really doing is preparing their reply. They're listening within their own frame of reference. They do not know how to get out of their own frame of reference. So to develop EQ, or emotional intelligence, this passion that comes from relationships, if you genuinely listen to other people, I mean, you take your magnificent work on chicken soup, look at those stories. Look at the listening that it took for these stories to be written and to be put together into the books that they formed. Those came from listening, and that is the development of EQ. SQ, or spiritual intelligence, is done in different ways by different people. People have to examine their own conscience. I've learned that peace of conscience is greater than peace of mind. If you literally will listen to the still small voice inside, it will tell you what you could do to be a better father, or mother, or brother. What person that you ought to rebuild a relationship with that you still care a lot about. Who you should forgive and forget past offenses so that you can rise above it and not be so small-minded, littleness of soul, to rise above it, to think abundantly. If people will listen to their conscience and then ask this question, does my life's work really add value to other people? Or am I just doing it to make a living? Which is fine, but that's only one of the four needs. The four needs are to live, to learn, love, to learn, and to leave a legacy. And you can't just meet one of those needs and develop passion. You have to love, that's relationship. You have to constantly learn. And you have to leave a legacy to matter, to add value, and to help people that follow you stand on the level that you left them at so that they go higher than you. I one time was working with the commander of a naval base, and he was undertaking a major leadership development program. And I said, why would you do this? I mean, you're out 30 years. You're going to retire this year. You'll never be made general. You're a colonel. Why would you pay the price to do this on your command? He said his father pulled him down to his bedside. His mother was standing there watching this scene and was crying herself. The father whispered to his son, "Son, don't do life like I did. I never did right by your mother or by you. I never made a difference. Son, promise me, you won't do life like I did." And that colonel said to me, "Stephen, that was the greatest gift and legacy my father ever gave me. I made my mind up then that I was going to make a difference." And he said, "That's why I'm undertaking this effort. And for the first time, I want my successor to do better than me. I want to build these principles so that they're into the structures and systems, so that they're institutionalized, so that the next person that comes will go to the next level. For the first time, I can say that's what I want. Up to this point, I've kind of wanted to be the high water mark and the one that got the recognition." He said, "But that became so unimportant to me when I got the message of my father." So those are the four needs inside all people. And all four have to be met, and that's when people find their voice, when they really overlap their talent, their passion, their need out there, and what their conscience gives them the sense of calling about. That's really when you see someone turned on. In fact, Jack, I can ask anybody, any audience, I do this all the time, how many of you have achieved your level of success, whatever it may be, partly or largely because someone believed in you when you didn't believe in yourself? And literally, you'll find 50, sometimes up to 75% of the people will raise their hands. And then if you listen to them, they'll become emotional as they talk about this scoutmaster, this parent, this teacher, this coach, whoever it is, that would not let them loose. They disciplined them, and they paid the price, and they held them to the responsible course. And they gave them essentially the opportunity to find their voice, and they just swear by these people. These people believed in them. I used to be a teacher at a university, and to this day, those students that I've had the greatest impact on, I know, are those that I really affirmed and would not let them off the hook, would hold them to the responsible course, because I knew they were capable of more, and they had to discipline themselves to pay the price and not to go for the course of least resistance, which would have been the easy course of just their popularity or their good looks or their athletic prowess. But they had to pay the price that I demanded of them. And I said, I'll never grade you on a curve. You're going to get a D or a C in this class, even though you're higher than others on the tests. Because I don't grade against a curve. I grade against your potential. And you yourself know you're capable of more than this. I will not let you off. And honestly, I got so close to these two. They knew I cared. Otherwise, I wouldn't have made such a huge effort to build that relationship to where they would take that kind of frank talk. I don't do it in a mean way, at a distance. I wouldn't do it unless I had a relationship where they knew I cared. But you have to care enough to confront them and then to affirm them.
I believe you. Real love really stands in the support of one's true potential, not in making people feel comfortable. A lot of our listeners have told us that even when they know what their talents and passions are, they often find that they still have fear, and that fear blocks them from moving forward. How do you advise people to overcome that fear and move forward?
I think that you have to kind of conclude that there is something more important than fear, so that even though you may be fearful, you subordinate it to a higher purpose. And if that higher purpose is one that excites you, that gets your passions going to where you really feel it is right, and if you start giving yourself to it little by little, you'll find that your fear will gradually recede. And because you'll become so concerned with other people and so less self-conscious that little by little, and it does come patiently and with real effort, but I think that you overcome it. I found, for instance, the illustration I used earlier, that if I will talk to a person in the audience and genuinely empathize with their mindset, I lose all fear in my speech. But initially, I had some, but I had to get so consumed with the purpose as being more important than the fear that the fear literally subsided over time.
That makes sense. Because I keep hearing this theme is when I'm focused on myself, kind of my little me, my own needs, my fears, then I get stuck. When I focus on serving others through this gift I have that's my passionate voice to bring forward into the world, then my focus isn't on me, it's on the purpose, it's on the mission, it's on them. And then I'm not in touch with my fear as much, I'm in touch with this thing I want to bring forward.
Right. And as you get better at doing that, then the fear recedes even more.
Right. So it's practice. It's
part of it is just practice and getting more competent.
Mm-hmm. How do you I know a lot of people, they I think we've talked about this a little bit, but I'm going to ask this because we kind of interviewed some people and said what they wanted to hear from you about. How do you express your unique voice when family, coworkers, bosses, or others simply don't want to hear it, when they just want you to fit in?
Well, I think you have to be respectful and appropriate. You can't just be kind of a loose cannon out there just having your way with people and saying what you want. I think you have to choose carefully the battles you want to fight so that you don't take on all battles all at once. And you have to be wise in selecting what is it that would really make a difference now. You see yourself as what I call a trim tabber, the small rudder that turns the big rudder that turns the big ship. So that you just stay in your own circle of influence, don't get outside your circle of influence into your circle of concern, and just magnify that as much as you can, particularly where it's outside your job, but still inside your circle of influence. Sometimes you can find a champion who has more formal authority, and if you have a lot of moral authority with that person, whether you have formal authority or not, if you have moral authority with that champion, sometimes that champion will kind of run interference for you and help create opportunities for you to express your talent and your passion. But yeah, on the other hand, you can't kind of indulge your fear and counsel with your fear and let that consume you and you lose courage. I find the best definition that I've ever come to about emotional maturity is very simple. Can you be both courageous and kind simultaneously? The essence of habit 4, think win-win, is that. Because most people have a tendency to be more considerate than they are courageous, and they go for lose-win. They become almost martyrs. They get stepped on. But the problem is that unexpressed feelings never die. They're buried alive, and they come forth later in ugly ways. Sometimes those ways are through psychosomatic illnesses. Sometimes people will live out their frustrations on their loved ones, which is a terrible thing because, you know, no one on their deathbed wishes they spent more time at the office. All that they really care about then are their loved ones. So we should always treat them best. But that often what happens when people are not courageous, if they're only considerate and only kind. On the other hand, many people are very courageous, very self-focused and self-centered, and very verbal and aggressive and strong with people, but they lack consideration. They don't have a sense of what's culturally appropriate, and they step over the line too much, and they go for win-lose. Both win-lose and lose-win in the long run will prove to be the undoing of both people and of the relationships that are formed. They're lose-lose. Win-lose and lose-win ultimately will come to lose-lose. That's what I have found. It's only people who are both courageous and kind, simultaneously. I mean, isn't that a beautiful definition of emotional maturity?
It really is. I'm going to hunch that the majority of people on this call, given where these people have come from and what they read and study a lot about in general, would tend to be more considerate instead of courageous. How do you encourage people to be more courageous? What would you advise people that are more, you know, codependent and considerate and loving and all that, but at the same time, to the extent that it stops them from achieving their own vision and dreams? How would you coach somebody? What would you tell them to develop more courageousness in their life?
I would encourage them to be a little more reflective about their life, to pause a little more, and to realize that there is a space between what happens to them and their response, and that they can choose their response in any given set of circumstances. Then I would encourage them to write a personal mission statement which embodies their expression of what gives their life its meaning, their purpose, their voice, their passion, and also the principles they're going to work by. Then I would advise them to practice in their mind's eye, through their imagination, living that mission statement in difficult situations where they normally would go for lose-win and capitulate, and see themselves being sensitive and kind, but also stepping up and speaking up in ways that are appropriate. And then I would encourage them to be authentic and to share what they're trying to do with people that they trust as a support team. You'll find that almost all real successful change in people comes when there is some kind of support team or accountability system like the AA or in a support group of people that believe in you. And the more authentic you can be, say, with your spouse or with a dear friend, and you can kind of talk it through and give an accounting, and they'll support you and affirm you and believe in you. If you do those things that I just talked about and realize that you can't run before you can walk, and you can't walk before you crawl, but you're beginning to do so, in a matter of a few weeks, perhaps months, you'll be astonished how courageous you can be in very, very tempting situations to where you'd normally capitulate and just give in and suck it up.
That's fabulous. I think, you know, I really am a big believer in visualizing what the qualities you want to have and expressing them fully in life. And
right.
I found a recent study that NASA did where they had the astronauts wear concave lenses for 30 days, which made the world appear upside down. But after 30 days, all the astronauts started, their brains started to flip the image right side back up again, even though they were still wearing these concave lenses 24 hours a day. And the neuroscientists are now telling us it takes about 30 days to create a new neural pathway in the brain. I think that's also true for a new self-image. And when that new self-image starts to be repetitively visualized, then those behaviors start to become more naturally activated, and we start to do things. We almost shock ourselves. So that's been my experience now, about a month minimum, and then you start to see some pretty amazing results. How, in your book, you talk about using our voices wisely to serve others. Don't we always serve others when we're expressing our unique nature? Isn't that, don't you kind of believe that each of us, if we fulfill our...
I think that if we truly, like you say, express our most unique, higher nature,
good.
We are serving others.
Mm-hmm.
I think that some people get very skilled in expressing their lower nature that is selfish and is manipulative and self-aggrandizing. And they can get good at that, and they can have a form of passion and enthusiasm. And I think sometimes they will mess up a marriage through selfishness. They'll overreact to children. They'll punish unwisely. They won't use discipline, which basically means discipled rather than punishment. And often they'll go without getting feedback, and then they get serious blind spots. It's like a deaf person that starts shouting because they can't hear themselves. And if they have a lot of formal authority, they can throw their weight around a lot. They'll often find themselves in the dark or when no one can see them, exploiting or taking advantage or bad-mouthing other people or violating their inward sense of conscience until their conscience gets corrupted. And they begin to define themselves in terms of power and wealth and prestige and money, and that they lose the true essence of moral authority. And so I think that, you know, this can be turned for good or for ill. I really do. I've been fascinated by the study of people like Gandhi, who was a visionary, passionate, but without any formal authority. Hitler had formal authority, ran by fear, and was driven by his ego until he became so thoroughly evil. And he was passionate and fired up, and he had charismatic qualities that were just totally amazing, to where he could just enrapture just hundreds of thousands of people through his enthusiastic, passionate rhetoric and get the whole public consumed with this victimism mentality so that they would scapegoat the Jews and other political prisoners that were looked on as being inferior. So I think I put a lot of emphasis, Jack, on up to you and tell you what you like to hear. I believe that true leadership is moral authority. Management is formal authority. And that great leaders are the great servants. And their highest quality is humility. Not domination, but humility. They are very strong-willed people, but their will is focused on serving other people and on contributing, not on their career, not on their self-aggrandizement, not on seeking recognition.
I hear you. I totally agree. In the next Passions interview, which is going to be on March 22nd, Chris and Janet are going to be interviewing your son, Stephen M.R. Covey.
Oh, great.
Yeah, and your son has written and spoken about the speed of trust in relationships and business and leadership. By way of introducing us to your son and his work, could you talk about the speed of trust and why this is so important, just to give us a little segue as into where we're going next?
Yeah, now, he really has drilled down on that subject, Jack, really. He'll go into both character and competence, and he'll show that the true trust over time comes through a what you might call a legacy of consistent results that convince other people that you are the real thing. That it isn't your words, it's your nature, it's your character combined with your competence together. And that once you have that, it's faster than even the internet. Because in the internet, you can make a mistake and you have to live with it. But where you have high trust relationships and you make a mistake, people will forgive you instantly because they know what you are. They know that you made a slip of the tongue. They know that you may not be politically correct all the time. That makes no difference because they know your heart. They trust you. They've had experiences with you over time. And what I call the emotional bank account has got huge, huge deposits in it, so that a few small withdrawals mean nothing. And you can just act so rapidly, you can communicate almost in shorthand with those people. I have certain relationships that we hardly even have to finish sentences because the nuanced communication is so real and so instantaneous. And it's amazing how synergistic and how creative. Oh, yeah, I see that. And then what about this idea? Oh, yeah, but I don't know about that. What about this one? They just build on each other's ideas. And it's amazing to see people that can talk in shorthand with each other. And you see the speed of trust. And you also see the enormous cost. And Stephen, my son, will get a lot into this. The enormous cost that you pay with low trust. And that it is the number one tax that far exceeds all of the other taxes and all of the other labor costs that you have. If you have low trust, every decision will be questioned. Your motives will be constantly questioned. People will operate on hidden agendas. You'll have the fruits of disempowerment, misalignment. Inevitably, people will not be on the same page. The costs are enormous when you have low trust and slows down things profoundly. And Stephen is the one who really helped my business be successful, because I'm kind of a top line person, but he understood both the importance of the top line and the bottom line. And so he made the business profitable because he understood cost control and the management of things as well as the leadership of people. He also is a person that inspired such trust that people would, you know, they would charge the hill for him. They would do anything for him. So what he's talking about, and I'm glad you're going to visit with him, because you're talking to a person who really has lived this and knows it and has built. I know it sounds like a prejudiced father, but you would talk to almost anyone who's associated with him. They'll say essentially what I'm saying right now.
That's great. At Healthy, Wealthy, and Wise, we believe strongly in the power of intention to manifest outcomes. And we'd like to put our intention along with your intention to support you. Tell us what your next biggest current project is and what intention you'd like all of us, along with our readers and listeners, to hold for you.
Well, I'm working on a book with Reader's Digest called Life by Choice, where we're going through the last, I think, 1,000 books that they put out, and trying to find the key stories that really make a huge difference, and they're excited by it, and so am I, and so is the publisher. Another one I'm working on is for attorneys, called Blessed Are the Peacemakers, and the subtitle is Synergy in the Prevention and Settlement of Disputes, and I'm trying to do this with our general counsel, and also with a federal judge who has a huge docket that is several times larger than most, because he will not hear the case in court unless they practice the kind of communication that I've been talking about here, this true empathic communication in chambers. And this will be for attorneys, for those who hire attorneys, and for those who don't want to hire attorneys. I've got a whole bunch of projects that I'm working on as well, and we're trying to take, we're into 120 countries now, and we're into about 80% of the Fortune 500. We're training executives, and we really want to take this whole concept of taking principles as the basis for our life and our leadership to billions of people around the world.
That's fabulous.
Our new mission statement is, for Franklin Covey, is we enable greatness in people and organizations everywhere. 8 words. And it's very visionary and inspiring. And working also on a project to build a statue of responsibility on the West Coast that would be the same size as the Statue of Liberty on the East Coast. This was a vision of Dr. Viktor Frankl, the Austrian psychiatrist imprisoned in the death camps of Nazi Germany.
Do you have a design for that statue?
Pardon?
Is there a design for that statue?
There is. Uh-huh. It shows a hand reaching down and a hand reaching up, so it communicates the interdependency of life and also the concept of lifting up other people.
That's fabulous.
And then there would be a museum and an international walkway where each country could contribute their own cultural expression of responsibility. Because freedom is only half the issue. Responsibility is the other half. And only when we use our freedom responsibly can we really make progress. Otherwise, both our economic system of free enterprise and our political system of democracy will not succeed. You have to have moral authority inside the people.
Now, when we had the Self-Esteem Task Force in California, everyone called it the Self-Esteem Task Force, but the real name was the Task Force for Promotion of Self-Esteem and Personal and Social Responsibility, because we felt, too, that just feeling good about yourself wasn't enough if you also weren't responsible to yourself and to the culture and to the other people you...
That's great, but they're totally interwoven, that you really find your life when you serve others.
What, if there was one single idea that you'd like to leave our listeners with tonight, what would that be?
I would say, listen to your conscience, start very small, make and keep a promise. Inwardly, people know some things they need to do right now. Everyone does. I do. You do. Everyone does. If they will just make a small promise and keep it, just very small that they can do, and keep it. Then make a little bigger promise later on and keep it. Then a little bigger one. Eventually what happens is that your sense of honor becomes greater than your moods. And when that happens, you'll discover the true source of power, and that's moral authority. Gandhi had it, and he was the father of the second largest country in the world and the largest democracy. Never was elected, never was appointed. Parents should do this. I would say one other thing to parents. Learn with your children to affirm their worth and potential so clearly they come to see it in themselves. Don't pay much attention just to weaknesses and behavior. See in your mind's eye their tremendous potential, latent. I do often when I teach this stuff is I use a match, you know, and you have to take discipline or friction to light the match, to unleash the tremendous power of that match, which can destroy a building or give light to a dark place or whatever. And then I take another match. And when you draw the two matches together, so the person feels, yes, you're sincere. You genuinely do care. You're a servant leader, and you're affirming me. As that warmth gets closer and closer, then it ignites the flame in the other. Then if you take that next match and light a candle so that you institutionalize the capacity to make this sustainable, and you build it into the structure, systems, and processes of an organization. In a family, for instance, the key to a whole family culture is how you treat the child that tests you the very most. And if you can show unconditional love to that one, the others will grow up with an abundance mentality and not a comparison-based identity where their sense of worth comes from being compared to other people. So I would say really affirm other people, their worth and their potential. And that's the essence of true leadership.
That's fabulous. Well, I have to say, this has been a wonderful conversation. I wish we had about 5 more hours. I mean, you have so much wisdom, so much depth and breadth of wisdom that comes from years of study and practice and personal work on yourself and walking your talk. I remember when you were at the self-esteem conference, you said when you got the invitation, you were only allowed to do so many talks a month that you'd committed this time to your family, but you were so excited about it, you went back to your family and said, you know, can I get a dispensation on this? And your family said yes. And I thought, isn't that great that you really live the principles you teach at that level? It was such a wonderful lesson, I think, for all of us who were in that audience. And I sit here again tonight just aware of the depth of wisdom and that you have from your own experience. And I want to really encourage all our listeners once again, if you haven't read The 7 Habits of Highly Effective People, definitely do that. Also get Stephen's latest book, The 8th Habit, From Effectiveness to Greatness. You can begin to get a sense of the tremendous depth of wisdom and practical tools that are here. And you can go to www.healthywealthyandwise, that's healthy, wealthy, the letter N as in Nancy, and then the word wise.com/Covey, which is Covey, and then .htm. You can order the book that way. I want to thank you again, all of you, for tuning in. I'm going to turn this call back to Janet. And it's been a wonderful, I'm really grateful for the opportunity to spend this time with Steve and Janet. So thank you for asking me to do this.
Oh, Jack, it was just an honor being able to listen to both of you. So much profound knowledge. Thank you so much for being our host. Just wonderful, too.
I want to thank both of you very, very much for this great thing you're trying to do to help people. I appreciate being part of it. Thank you.
Oh, Stephen, thank you for sharing, as Jack said, your profound depth of wisdom with us tonight. And it's no wonder you've been called one of the most influential thinkers of our time. And as we said at the beginning of this call, each of you on the phone will want to get a copy of The 8th Habit, as Jack said. And if you're truly committed to discovering and living your personal destiny, you'll run out today and order it immediately. And one of the wonderful surprises that you receive when you get this book is a DVD that contains 16 different video presentations by Dr. Covey. In fact, we found out today that Stephen's office let us know that this DVD alone used to be sold for $500, but you can buy the book today for less than $20 and get the DVD along with the book. So this is a wonderful, wonderful opportunity for all of us. And again, as Jack said, go to www.healthywealthyandwise.com/Covey, Covey, .htm. So thank you, everyone, for being with us tonight. Be sure to join us in 2 weeks when we interview Dr. Covey's son, Stephen M. R. Covey, on The Speed of Trust. I can't hardly wait, especially as it relates to families and teams. The younger Stephen was CEO, as Dr. Covey said, of the Covey Leadership Center and responsible for doubling its revenues to over $115 million. So you definitely won't want to miss this call. We look forward to being with all of you again. And remember, you are unique. No one else but you can give the world your unique gifts. Our hope is that these calls will help you to discover your passions and live your personal destiny. Good night, everyone.
Talk to you tonight.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.